I call this Committee on Housing, Finance, and Policy to order. Let it be known that we have quorum here this afternoon. Welcome, members. We have a couple bills on our agenda today, but first order of business, we will look for an approval of the minutes. Representative Scrabba, have you reviewed the minutes?
I have, and I approve the minutes. Move the minutes.
Representative Scrabba moves the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor adopting the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. All right, we'll move to our first bill on the agenda, House File 933. Representative Nash, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 933 to come before the committee, and I believe we are laying this over for possible inclusion.
That is correct, Representative Nash. This bill will be brought before the committee for being laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 933 is another effort in making housing more available and affordable, and would seek to address some of the encumbrances that PUDs bring to light, as they seem to be the de facto utilization in cities right now. A number of years ago, the number of PUDs was much less than it is today. And, once again, we're trying to really address the cost of housing. And what this would say is that, and you can read it in line 1.8, is that a municipality must not require a planned unit development agreement in lieu of a proposed residential development if the proposed residential development complies with the existing zoning ordinance already. So effectively, it's creating a duplicative effort that may actually go above and beyond what is in the base ordinance. So that is the gist of the bill. I have a testifier, Mr. Chair, who can go into some greater detail for you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. We'll move into testimony. So I believe if you want to introduce yourself for the record and proceed to the testimony. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Igo, Chair Howard, and committee members. My name is Jacob Steen. I'm an attorney and shareholder with the Larkin Hoffman Law Firm, and we represent Housing First here today. I'm the chair of our real estate and land use department at Larkin Hoffman, where my primary practice is zoning and development. But prior to practicing law, I was also a city planner for the city of Minneapolis. So I can tell you I've been on both sides of the table on this issue, and I believe in zoning is a really strong and powerful local tool to manage growth, manage development, but also set expectations for the market. And that's why I think this is an important bill before you. So what is a planned unit development or a PUD? I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are aware. But this is a very useful tool that is intended to offer flexibility with respect to development. Typically, we see these used with respect to a master planned development, oftentimes what you'd think of as a single family subdivision. It's intended to allow for a flexibility or what we would otherwise see come through as a variance on a one-off case. But this would be additional flexibility or relaxation of lot widths, lot minimums, setbacks. And the idea is that in exchange for that flexibility, the developer is expected to offer a higher level of amenity. The idea is that they're going above and beyond the code in exchange for what would typically be a variance. Now, as Representative Nash said, these traditionally have been implemented in rare cases. It was really the exception to the rule, but it is now virtually mandatory in many communities, particularly in the metro area. Many cities don't do this outright. They don't say that a PUD is mandatory, but they effectively force developers and landowners into the PUD process. And the way they do this is they impose restrictions that are unrealistic, at least under today's modern standards. For example, you'd see a city imposing a 100-foot lot width, maybe even a 25,000-square-foot lot minimum, and then overlay those requirements with a 10 to 15% affordability requirement in a single-family neighborhood. And if any of you have been tracking the cost of housing, which I'm sure you all have, you'd know that that is virtually impossible to do. You can't make affordable housing if you've got large lot development. So developers are forced to follow the PUD path, and they essentially have no alternative but to enter into a PUD process. Now, what do the cities get from a PUD? Well, by forcing a city into a PUD, you have the ability to impose exactions on developers. Again, right, the expectation is that they are going above and beyond. But many times these exactions exceed what would traditionally be their statutory authority. And they do this under the guise of a negotiation. These exactions will take many forms. Oftentimes it's additional park dedication, trail dedication. Oftentimes you'll be required to pay for off-site infrastructure, sometimes a half or even a mile away from the site. And it's important to remind everybody that every time you impose an additional cost on a development, you are creating an obstacle that makes that development less viable and makes housing less affordable. So this bill is not intended to eliminate PUDs. It's still an important tool, but it's intended to give developers and landowners a choice of when they want to pursue a PUD. It just really resets the deck and creates some parity between that developer and the city. It still allows developer to choose that process. It also creates some predictability and hopefully avoids the unnecessary process. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I appreciate the time today and want to say thank you to Representative Nash for bringing this forward. It's really important to make housing more available and make housing affordable for all homeowners.
Thank you, Mr. Steen. We'll move into the next couple of members who have people have signed up to testify first. Next on the list will be Daniel Lightfoot.
Oh, hi.
Welcome back to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
What are the chances that you testify on one of my bills?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot, the League of Minnesota Cities. As the committee knows, the League represents the collective interests of our 841 member cities across the state. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House File 933. As Mr. Steen mentioned, planning developments are, in fact, an important tool for both cities and developers. Cities cannot possibly factor in every aspect of development in their base zoning and land use ordinances, making the planning and development a helpful tool for both cities and developers to deviate from base zoning to get a project across the finish line. Oftentimes, the planning and development has been used, for additional affordability for units. Often is a path for greater density in developments, as well as mixing property uses on the same site plan. So think of your mixed-use development that includes both multifamily, single-family owner-occupied housing, commercial industrial property, et cetera, on one site plan. We do appreciate the bill that the bill doesn't prohibit this tool in any way. And while I think certainly from our perspective organizationally, the general concept of the state prohibiting cities from requiring a plan unit development that otherwise complies with existing regulation in a site plan is fair. I think the general gist of the bill is a fair approach. It is not at all preempting the ability for cities to utilize the planning and development in any way. That said, I think we do have some questions around how the language would work in practice. Developments that comply with zoning and subdivision ordinance is often sort of the baseline upon which PUD discussions might occur to create that flexibility, and we want to better understand the language written now. Does that language sort of prohibit that baseline, that level of consideration? You know, more specifically, whether a proposed development meets ordinance standards is usually determined in the application review itself, and it's unclear how, like, a predetermination of that compliance would be made in order for that PUD prohibition to kick in. So we'll just want to try to address that a little bit as this conversation continues. And then lastly, the language in lines 1.10 that says or qualifies as a conditional use, that language is fairly expansive in scope and may have some unintended consequences. And then I would just say lastly, paragraph 3, there is current language in subdivision statute that already has fairly substantive provisions about application review and the effective approval. So in Minnesota Statutes 462.358, There is a paragraph that states that cities have to approve a preliminary plat that meets applicable standards and criteria in ordinance, and then later in that same subdivision provides a two-year right to deal as approved. And so I just don't know if paragraph three is necessary. But again, appreciate, Mr. Chair, members, the opportunity to testify. Thank you, Representative Nash, for conversations on this bill, and look forward to continuing them as the conversation moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. Next on the list will be Jennifer Monson. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Monson. I am the Economic Development Manager for the City of Maple Grove. I am an American Institute certified planner and have been practicing planning in this for more than 15 years, including 9 years in the state of Minnesota. On behalf of the City of Maple Grove, the Municipal Legislative Commission, and the League of Minnesota Cities, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House File 933. As the folks before me have mentioned, PUDs are an important tool in the developers and communities toolbox to create mutually beneficial developments that balance the unique features and desires of individual cities, developer goals, and the Met Council's regional goals. We do not require a developer to do a PUD. If a development meets our base zoning and land use ordinances, a PUD is not needed, and therefore conceptually we don't have a concern with the approach of the bill. A PUD is always at the request of developers as they want to do something that is different than what is allowed under the city's adopted zoning ordinances. PUDs provide a collaborative process to create development that goes above and beyond what is required under typical zoning requirements to create unique neighborhoods, commercial nodes, and special places across Minnesota. Specifically for residential development, PUDs offer for greater flexibility in lot size, layout, and design. It's used to create a mix of residential densities and varying lot sizes in a single neighborhood, which traditional zoning may not allow. It also allows developers to concentrate development in certain areas while preserving open space, recreational amenities, and ensures the overall design accommodates both density and livability. Residential PUDs enable the inclusion of affordable housing units through density bonuses or reduced lot requirements. This flexibility can reduce overall development costs, which can then be passed on to buyers or renters in the form of more affordable and or attainable housing options. PUDs also create development that help better achieve local planning goals than traditional zoning might. PUDs are used to reduce sprawl and encourage mixed use and higher density development. They also allow projects to more closely align with Met Council goals, such as promoting walkability, increasing residential density and affordability, reducing traffic congestion, and ensuring environmental sustainability. A local example of how a PUD was utilized in Maple Grove is Maple Grove's Rush Hollow neighborhood, which was approved in 2022. Traditional zoning would have required 75% of the 160-acre development to be developed as 80-foot wide lots. By using a PUD, the developer was able to include a wide range of lot sizes, including 239 lots with varying in size from 50 to 80 foot wide, an 80-unit senior multifamily condominium, and 208 townhome units. The final details and requirements of the PUD are included in the PUD agreement, which is typically recorded on the property and already cannot be changed without approval by both the developer and the city. From an implementation perspective, Maple Grove does have a few questions as to how the language and practice would work in the development process. As Mr. Lightfoot stated, the determination of whether a development meets ordinance standards is generally determined in the application review process or in pre-application meetings when a developer proposes a concept that doesn't meet the city's traditional zoning requirements. So we're not certain as to how a predetermination of compliance would be made in order for a PUD prohibition to kick in. Additionally, while the City of Maple Grove posts information regarding new developments on our website, including required postings for PUD ordinances, the practicality of posting a PUD agreement to our website even 7 days before a council review would be challenging. Typically, the PUD approvals direct staff and attorneys to draft and negotiate the PUD agreement after the PUD ordinance has been approved by the governing body. Most often, PUD agreements require several rounds of back-and-forth negotiation between the developer and the city's legal team. And the contract may also need to be reviewed and approved by the development's lender prior to closing on the project's financing, which might not be on board at the time of city approvals. Typically, the PUD agreement is not finalized and signed until shortly before construction begins. I appreciate that the League and other city groups will continue to work on Representative Nash's on this bill, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to stand for member questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jason Waddell. I'm the Prior Lake City Manager, so I'm testifying here today on behalf of the City of Prior Lake. Just wanted to make a couple of really brief comments. First, related to the previous testifier commenting on cities' straight zoning requiring lots of 100 feet in width and making it almost forcing developers to go with the PUD route to get a normal-sized lot development. If you're in the 7-county metro area, we already have density requirements we're required to hit as part of our comprehensive plans. Even for single-family developments, we have to hit 2.5 units per acre. So when you factor in right-of-way and stormwater ponds and all the other things, there's no way we could even have 100-foot-wide lots in a standard single-family neighborhood if you're in the 7-county metro area and you're subject to the Met Council. But that being said, we do see the value in PUDs, but the way we do PUDs is 100% consistent with the way this bill is written. We don't require them. We would much prefer straight zoning. It makes the process go much smoother and quicker and helps the developers get on their way. We post our PUDs well in advance of their approvals, and we don't modify them without both parties being in agreement. So with that, we would support this bill and authors Nash and Igo on the bill. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify from the public? All right, seeing none, we'll go into member questions. First on this will be Representative Rehrauer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for bringing this bill. I think it's important that we are discussing zoning as we continue to try to encourage development. My main question is, so as a city council member, I saw PUD developments come in and come through and happen. The one I'm thinking of had much narrower streets, and it was something allowed by the PUD amendment, but wouldn't have been allowed in the city's normal zoning. So I guess my main question is just, could they still do that increased density, narrower streets type of project if we took away the ability to have PUD as part of zoning? Does that make sense?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to reiterate, this doesn't take away the opportunity to go into PUD. The builders still could choose to go into PUD. The effort here in the bill says that a city may not require things to go straight to PUD. I hope that answers your question.
Good. Okay. Next on the list, we Vice Chair Dotsoff.
Thank you, Chair Eichel, Representative Nash. Question I have is, we've heard a lot about larger cities. How about some of the smaller cities? What guardrails do we have in place where they may be working with limited staff to assure that they could actually implement some of these changes?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I served as mayor in a medium-sized town, and you know, at the time it was 8,000 to 10,000. I think the city staff certainly could do both scenarios if they were very capable people that have my respect. I think once again, to go back to the question that was just answered, this doesn't necessitate banning. It's not banning PUDs. What it's saying is, if the builder chooses to, that they still can, but that the city cannot require them. And I really think that, you know, the city planning staff, if you ask them to do one or ask them to do the other, they're going to be more than capable of handling that. I think what this is, the goal of this is trying to do, is to get to the heart of the issue of over-regulating things and making sure that we don't get into a scenario where a PUD is required, so that that we have the ability for builders to build the product that they want in the way that they want and provide a value to the people who are trying to move there in whatever city you might want to call that place home.
Vice Chair Dotsoff.
That's it. Thank you.
All right. Next on the list will be Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps one of the previous testifiers can answer this. Are illegal or unlawful terms ever included in a planned unit development agreement? Has that been something that it's ever happened?
Representative Nash.
I would defer to my testifier on that.
Chair Igo, Representative Mecklen. I just to repeat the question, do illegal or unlawful fees get attached? I'm sorry, say that again.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Illegal or unlawful terms ever included in an agreement?
Mr. Steen.
Chair, Representative Mecklen, I want to be sensitive about that. If what you mean by illegal and unlawful, you mean inconsistent with Supreme Court decision and state law, then yes. There are oftentimes, again, cities often impose these exactions under the guise of a negotiation. A developer has very limited options in these cases to get straight zoning approvals. So they have a choice of either agreeing to these terms, which are oftentimes monetary, usually unlawful fees that exceed their authority, or they face either an incomplete determination or a recommendation of denial by city staff.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are those the only types, or have you seen others, other scenarios? Or, I mean, there was something mentioned about once the agreement is made, it cannot be changed unless agreed to by both sides of the equation. Have you ever, I mean, I personally have an email about this, but everything is agreed upon. It's on the agenda for the city council meeting. They go into recess. The city then wants a sizable amount of money per lot. It was not part of the agreement. When pressed back and stating, what if I don't pay it, and bear in mind this was April 1st of this given year when this happened, well, we see your excavation equipment is on site. We'll be able to keep tabling this till December. And that actually happened right before COVID, so they paid all that money. It was a sizable amount of money. And then COVID disrupted the market, so they literally sat all that money out for well over a year and a half or 2 years. Do you see things like that?
Mr. Steen.
Yeah, Chair Igo, Representative Mecklen. I can't say that I'm familiar with that scenario specifically. What I would say is that that is part of the risk of the PUD process and the development agreement, is that oftentimes conditions can be approved at the city council level, and it is I think in law school we call it a contract of adhesion. It's a take it or leave it contract. And it does really put a developer into a very tough spot, at which point they have very little recourse other than to try to renegotiate it, which means going back to staff and going back to council again.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have no more questions, but I will give the scenario. In that particular scenario, each of those lots went up $18,000. Right off the cuff, off that city's ask. So when we're talking about affordable housing, I don't believe we're getting that. Those types of situations, this is a personal friend of mine. I have the email. And if you actually pull the minutes from that meeting, it all lines up. So these are things that are, I think what we're all trying to get at is to try to drive this, get back to affordable housing. But, yes, local control is usually better. But when these types of things are repetitive stories that these developers, I mean, imagine the number one of the largest costs to moving that equipment is moving it and then transporting it back. And so you've already got the cost of the land. You're that far in. There's literally no turning back. And that's where we find a lot of these things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, last on the list, I have Representative Scrava.
Thank you. Sorry. As someone who sat on a board of variance, a board of adjustment for many years, the question, we get to violate the law every time we meet if we think the findings are good. You vary from the law. That's what we do as planning and zoning people. But when can they still use this planned unit development as a tool to avoid the variances, saying, if you will do this, we will give you this, I've worked with PUDs up in the woods in the middle of nowhere. It's amazing. Or CICs, it's like, why are you doing that? But they do all that in rural Minnesota a fair amount. But again, it's the developer has an issue with the rules the way they read, and they want to work with it. Representative Nash, I like the idea of what you did with this bill, because you're taking away someone's ability to force someone to do this. You know, there's a lot of paths you can go down, but I'll let you answer. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Well, I think we'd heard in the very beginning, and we've heard from multiple testifiers, that that's sort of the very genesis of PUD is, rather than issue a variance, they'll go into PUD, and if that's the request of the builder, then that's something that the builder knows going in and is a negotiated tactic. The goal of the bill, though, is to not allow cities to require entrance into PUD. I think that's the nuance, and we've heard, I'm grateful for the municipal testifiers that are supportive of the overall goal of the bill. I think that what we're trying to find here is the answer to how do we make sure that this does not happen prescriptively moving forward. So that's the goal of the bill.
All right, I'll go to Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Igoe. And I actually had a few questions for Mr. Lightfoot. So in your testimony, we heard about some of the tools that cities use PUDs for, like additional density and affordability were mentioned. But are there other uses?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard. Yeah, I mean, I think, the main use would be, again, to deviate from base zoning and land use ordinance. I think you think of a site like, right here in St. Paul, like the Ford site, or even when you go down to St. Louis Park, like the Miracle Mile off of Highway 100 there, you know, those are examples of planned unit developments that in a given site, in a given platted area, you have multiple uses of different types of property that wouldn't otherwise fit neatly into an approved site plan from a base zoning perspective. Affordability is one aspect. Density, both by increasing density in by way of single family on individual sites or density bonuses for multifamily, mixing property uses. Those are just to name a few, but the applications in terms of just how those vary can be broad. And again, it's a give and take for both the city and the developer. The developer gets stuff in this process as well. It's not just cities exacting their own locally identified goals out of the process. It's a two-way street.
Chair Howard.
How about aesthetic mandates? Did they ever get negotiated, like the types of housing are going to have a specific type of siding or a specific feature? Does that ever happen in a PUD process?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I am not familiar with any like specific project off the top of my head where the planned unit development was used to exact material design standards. As we've discussed in this committee prior, there are cities that do have material design standards in base zoning ordinance, and Representative Nash and I have had probably more than one conversation about that aspect as well. I'm willing to continue to have conversations about that. I'm not, I suppose if it was a deviation from base zoning ordinance, it's possible, but I'm not aware of a specific circumstance that I could call upon off the top of my head.
Chair Howard.
I have heard of those examples. How about has a PUD process ever led to the necessitation of an HOA?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I don't believe, again, I have information on a specific instance. Cities are not able to compel the creation of a homeowners association. We may, through the development agreement process, if there is the presence of common elements or private common area property, ensure that those common elements or private common area property is maintained somehow, and generally that is through a homeowners association. But I'm not aware of a planning and development process that compelled the creation of a homeowners association in a subdivision.
Chair Howard.
I'll just say that from our conversations with housing developers and folks, it's clear to me that PUDs aren't always often used for this, what's stated public good of affordability or density. but sometimes they're used for ways that drive up the cost of housing, like things that end up in an HOA or aesthetic mandates or other pieces that end up raising costs. Another question, a city planner said that, you know, they would prefer straight zoning. Do you think that's true for most cities, that they would prefer that?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, just to clarify by what you mean on straight zoning.
As opposed to the PUD process, that they would prefer a straight zoning process.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I think it's important, you know, obviously the base zoning and land use ordinance is the important baseline for development, but I think it's also important to understand that base zoning and land use ordinance cannot possibly factor in all aspects and all types of every possible development that would come into a city. I think, you know, part of the reason we've seen more pervasive use of the plan unit development is the types of products and the types of more complex site plans being put together that mix property uses, that mix densities in certain areas. In terms of, you know, I won't speak for city planners, but when I've discussed the planning and development process with cities, it is and continues to be an important tool to deviate from those base zoning and land use ordinances to get a project to yes, to work with a developer to ensure that a site plan vision is achieved in that process.
Chair Howard.
But theoretically, the purpose of having zoning is to set the ground rules for development to occur. That's the reason that you zone something a particular way. Is that not true?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, yes. The base zoning and land use ordinance is in ordinance to set the parameters for certain types of development, whether it be residential or commercial industrial. But again, tools are needed, whether it's a variance, as Representative Scrabo was talking about, or planning a development, to deviate from that baseline to account for all of the various types of development that could come into a city.
Chair Howard.
So when I hear the word deviate, how I think about that is you have the base, like you said, that's the normal, right? And when you're going to deviate from the normal, you go to this other process. Do you, if that's the case, could you provide some information about how often, when housing developments happen, how often they use their base zoning or how often they use a planned unit development, say, in the Twin Cities area?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I don't have that information off the top of my head, but I'm happy to follow up with that information and get that to you. Chair Howard.
I do have that information for several cities. The city of Chaska, 97% of their housing developments in the 2010s were a planned unit development. We heard from Maple Grove, 95%. Carver, 93%. Blaine, 91%. So if the deviation is at an almost 100% level, that's not a deviation, is it? That's the norm.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I'd have to continue to look at some of the information that you provided. The bill before us is an aspect in terms of a concept where if something does meet the base zoning and land use ordinance, I would very much agree with Representative Nash that it's not something that a PUD would need to be forced on a development. That said, there are lots of market changes that are happening where there is a necessity for a tool to be used to ensure that both the goals and the locally identified goals in a city and a community are achieved, and from a developer perspective, that a site plan can be realized with some flexibility.
Just Chair Howard.
Just one last question. Rather than pursue a PUD process, is there a reason why cities don't just modify their zoning? Why go to the PUD process versus just make a change, modify the zoning to accommodate?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I would say many cities have looked inward at their base zoning and land use ordinances to update those ordinances and work with developers to kind of understand the genesis in terms of how those updates would reflect on the market. That said, again, the planning and development process is an important tool to provide that flexibility. We cannot, even in base zoning and land use ordinances, factor in every type of project that's going to come before the city, whether it be multifamily, single family, commercial, industrial, et cetera. Appreciate the line of questioning.
Chair Howard.
And I'll just say, you say many cities have, but as I said, most cities aren't. Most cities are forcing every development in the PUD process. And I do wonder if part of that is they use it to exact large fees that end up raising the price of housing on Minnesotans. Thank you, Representative Nash. This is a good bill. And excuse for the questions. I realize that the pushback from city groups is a little lighter than on some of the other bills. I just want to comment that it continues to be a frustration that we keep having bills that move forward to lower the cost of housing, make it easier to build more housing. And from the city groups, all we hear is concerns, all we hear is no, and we never hear actual solutions. And so, Representative Nash, thank you for bringing forward a solution.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I have nothing else to say after that. That was well said by my co-chair. To you, Representative Nash, on your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to say thank you that a lot of the city groups said that they saw good things in the bill and understood the direction of it. And I will personally say it makes my heart soar like a hawk to have Daniel Lightfoot say nice things about my bills. that's a joke. We're good. We're friends. But, you know, the problem is real. And we have to do our job as the Housing Committee, as legislators, to try to find real solutions. And I would hope that this could get included in some format after we negotiate with some of the people who have expressed minor concerns today, that we could put this in our omnibus bill. Because I really do think that this is a piece of policy that we can put into effect so that we can make ultimately the price of a home more achievable for the people who, as a committee, we've all said that we're committed to make sure that they're able to do so. So appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, and Chair Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Nash. And with that, House File 933 is laid over. All right, members will move to our next item on the agenda, which is House File 1931. Representative Bonner. Representative Mecklen, since you're a member of the committee, will you make the motion to move House File 1931 to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law?
So moved. You just did it for me, but thank you.
I did it for you.
I moved 1931 and we moved to Judiciary.
Representative Bonner, to your bill.
To our bill. thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to point out that this is a bipartisan coalition. We're all going to sing Kumbaya next. for today, in the 2024 legislature, we passed a bill to create a legislative work group to study common interest communities and homeowners associations, and specifically reform. The group consisted of 20 members from across the industry, convened for 14 sessions, hearing 30 to 40 hours of testimony, held three public listening sessions in every area of the metro to hear firsthand from homeowners and board members and community members about the challenges of HOAs. Themes quickly emerged, highlighting where the current statute was clearly inadequate to protect homeowners and associations themselves. Those themes form the basis for the series of recommendations to the legislature, which was unanimously adopted by all members representing each of the areas. That leads us here today to one of those recommendations. So let's talk about briefly, why do we need AG enforcement? For homeowners and associations, we've created sort of a quasi-government entities with few checks and balances and little, if any, legal recourse when things go awry. Attorneys and courts are hesitant to represent consumers due to the prohibitive attorney fees and overburdened courts with little appetite in cases where citizens have been harmed. In short, when the dream of home ownership turns into your worst nightmare, it creates an insurmountable power imbalance for homeowners. with no legal recourse, and it's just wrong. For associations, boards, and homeowners who fall victim to the rampant conflicts of interest, kickbacks, and insurance fraud that can drive up the cost of repairs, maintenance, monthly assessments, and to unsustainable heights. Once considered an affordable path to home ownership, the lack of consumer protections has led to skyrocketing costs, pricing some out, and forcing others to sell their little piece of the American dream. While once rare, today 82% of new homes in the marketplace are in an HOA. With the increase both nationally and here at home, our laws have simply not kept pace, nor has our ability to enforce them. The bill does one simple thing. It makes it abundantly clear that the office of the AG has the authority to enforce Section 1 or 515B. As the people's lawyer, it just makes sense that homeowners, boards, and associations who find themselves in murky waters should have legal means to regain ground and obtain justice when the law has failed them. Please note again that this bill has a team of four chief authors in both chambers and wide bipartisan support of its co-authors, including the chairs of this committee. And with that, I have with me today a testifier from the AG's office. I'll let her take it away.
Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jessica Whitney. I am a Deputy Attorney General over the Consumer Protection Section in the AG's office. Thank you for having me here today. I will try and keep my testimony very brief, like the bill itself. We support House File 1931. It makes it clear that the AG's office has authority to enforce the protections under Chapter 515B. We receive hundreds of calls a year on complaints on HOAs. That makes them a fairly significant category for our complaints. To date this year, in the first 3 months, we've already received 98. So again, on pace to keep up with hundreds of complaints each year. So we think this bill will allow us to help protect those consumers and boards and associations and protect them without fears of retaliation. When we talk to consumers, they often mention fears of getting retaliated against by their own HOA in the home that they live in and the high cost. For example, they're talking about a $10,000 assessment they want to fight, and it would cost them more to hire their own attorney. So we strongly support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one more on the list, Becky Cole, who I believe is remote. So you feel free to unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Becky Cole, and I'm a homeowner in support of this bill. This bill is important because it is a step to getting past the way too many myths and misconceptions that most of the problems with homeowners are just a matter of not getting along with your neighbors or not reading the documents. And there's a great deal of information that's not included in the documents. It also recognizes that there are industry-wide business practices that leave homeowners vulnerable to exploitation, would not be tolerated in any other type of business. For example, when my unlicensed management company is the sole signer on a bank account of over $1.8 million in an account that's not even in Minnesota, it's a business practice that would not be tolerated in any other industry. Once I asked my management company where their authority comes from, in any other industry, they would be a contractor of whoever is on the articles of incorporation. So I asked about their relationship to Centex, the developer who is named on our articles of incorporation. They don't have a contract with Centex, but did say their authority comes from the bylaws. The management company wrote the bylaws. So when I asked Centex why this doesn't matter to them, all I got was ignored. We just heard in the previous conversation that the nature of the contract with the developer can't be changed without an agreement of both the developer and the municipality. However, anytime we go to the municipality, they just throw up their hands and they say, we can't do anything. But it's not like they can't, they just won't have a conversation with the developer or to put things better in place than this dump and run business model. I've seen a communication from a law firm about determining who is a good candidate for foreclosure based on how much equity the homeowner has in their home. The recommendation was that if there's a great deal of equity, foreclose. But if they don't have equity, then put a lien on their home. But there's nowhere in it that they're suggesting that to offer a payment plan to the homeowner. This law firm also has their own foreclosure department and their own debt collection department. These are business practices that in any other industry would be regulated and be considered wrong. We want what others have. We want somebody like the Attorney General's office to be able to stand up for us and to be able to call out what these are, as we need a better way to do things. It's time for a new industry standard, and this is one piece that will help us get there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cole. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. First on the list will be Vice Chair Dotseff.
Thank you, Chair. I go more of a comment for the AG would be, question would be is I've got a concern that you're properly staffed to actually make sure that these are actually properly enforced. Do you believe that you have enough staffing to actually enforce any laws that are on the books?
Ms. Whitney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, I believe we do. I mean, it'd be a new foray into enforcing it that way. And so next year, we might come back and tell you how we're doing if you don't think we're enforcing it enough. But I think the answer at this time is yes.
Vice Chair Dotseff.
Just a follow-up question, Chair Igel. Just some assurance that we won't be looking for hiring additional staffing, that you believe you've got enough staffing within house right now.
Ms. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, I can't see that happening. I'm a lawyer. I'm giving you I'm prevaricating. But, yes, at this time, I think we feel strongly that we're okay with staffing.
Thank you. That's it.
Next on the list will be Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Igo. Thank you, Representatives, for presenting that. I'm going to kind of build on Representative Dotseff's question. And it kind of leads into what I was going to ask, is how do you believe that you are staffed correctly for this? Because I dropped off a letter last week asking for help on the manufacturing homes in Cimarron, and it's not the first time a letter has been dropped off, and still nobody's heard from the Attorney General's office yet regarding any acknowledging it or willing to get involved. So I'm concerned that if you're going to be adding this on again, when we're still waiting for responses previously on other issues like the mobile home park or manufacturing home, that you don't have the staff or it won't be able to be addressed. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Whitney.
We're looking at the mobile home case you dropped off. We are actively investigating it. I was on a call this morning about it. Our investigations are not public while they're going on. If anyone reaches out, we can tell them we're working on it. So I will say we are looking at those matters. We feel, as we've discussed staffing levels, that it will be okay.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair.
Next on the list will be Representative Amanya Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair Igo, for the opportunity. Thank you so much, Representative Barner, for bringing this bill up. As a new homeowner, last like 2-3 years now, one of the reasons why my husband and I chose not to buy a home that was within HOA was because of the horror stories that we've heard in the past from homeowners and them getting caught up in, you know, just crazy situations. And so for me, from my end, I appreciate you putting the work into this because, again, homeowners are here and they're expected to make sure that they meet their mortgage. And then now, when they get themselves into situations, they might end up losing their own home, where some of them have invested their whole life saves into it. So the idea of having somebody fighting for the homeowner in this situation is really appealing to me, and I appreciate that we are fighting for homeowners in this situation. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Trying to do my research while we were getting ready for the question, but Representative Bonner, you had made a comment about quasi-government organizations, these HOAs are, and kind of where I went down a rabbit hole, I started reading more and more about what is a quasi and how do they get to be this powerful, you know, like, and it does straddle the private and public, because who should tell me what color I can have my house? But it's enforceable to them. And who enforces that? So I want to thank the Assistant Attorney General. I was going to direct one of my questions to the people that were here yesterday, because their cases to me were atrocious. You know, it's like there's a bad apple in the orchard, and we got to help them. But how do you guys define what an HOA is? Is it a private organization, or is it a governmental organization? Thank you.
Ms. Whitney.
Mr. Chair, we don't consider them government organizations. I mean, we do consider them private, and we define them if they meet the parameters of that definition listed in the statute. Sorry, I don't have a better answer than that. Like, it's sort of like we know it when it falls within that definition.
All right, that's good. Thank you.
Chair, Representative Bonner, to your bill.
All right, thank you for that. As it was kind of mentioned here, we do want to make clear that this is part of a larger package of bills. The policy bill, which covers a number of issues that you might hear about, actually is also traveling, and in fact that will be in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate on Friday, and it continues to seek its next stop here in Commerce in the House. But what we want to make abundantly clear is that Minnesotans have made abundantly clear to us is that the abuses, the kickbacks, the fraud, it's got to stop. They've made it clear to their legislators sitting in all of these seats that they need us to be their voice, and they need the AG to be their champion. So I want to thank you all for your support of House File 1931 and help to get it on its way to its next stop. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Mecklen renews his motion that House File 1931 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? The motion prevails, and it's on its way. All right, members, we'll move to our last item on the agenda, which is House File 2309. We laid this bill over for possible inclusion, but now we've made a decision that we'll be sending it to the General Register. We will not be taking new testimony. So, Chair Howard, you're going to go up, do you want to go up front, Representative Rehauer? Representative Rehauer moves that House File 2309 be referred to the General Register. I will move right away into amendments. I believe, Chair Howard, you'll be offering the first amendment.
Yes, and a little more context. Chair Igo and I have talked and negotiated to this being a vehicle for our housing policy bill. And so along with the bill that Representative Rehauer introduced and walked through, we'll have a few amendments on include some of the bipartisan items that we've heard this year. And so I'm first going to move the A1 amendment. And to describe the A1 represents House File 2480, which is a bill that I carried. This is a bill we heard, was it last week?
Mm-hmm.
Last week that came to us from our public housing entities and NARO, and to make sure that they can navigate and secure resources for general obligation dollars.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the E1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. We have another amendment in front of us. Will be the A2 amendment. Chair Howard, I believe you have this one as well.
I'll move the A2. The A2 includes two bills that we heard yesterday. Representative Fu Lee's bill, which would include an adaptive reuse as an eligible use of housing infrastructure bonds, and would include Representative Kozlowski's bill that would allow HRAs to be authorized to establish local housing trust funds.
Is there any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. We have another amendment in front of us. I will be moving the A4 amendment. The A4 amendment is a bill we heard last week. It is a Representative Nash bill for the promotion of materials and rights and obligations of landlords and residential tenants on the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's website. Pretty simple amendment to the bill. And with that, we'll move in if there's any discussion or questions to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. We have one more amendment in front of us today, so I'll move the A5 amendment. The A5 amendment is Vice Chair Dotseth's bill from way back at the start of committee back in February, with changes to the workforce housing fund. If there's any, is there any discussion to the A5 amendment? Representative Howard.
Just on this, I think this is related to adding workforce housing to the state housing tax credit. Just want to provide that additional context.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Any further discussion? All those in favor of adopting the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. All right, that brings us to House File 2309 as amended. Is there any discussion to the bill as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of moving House File 2309 to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, members, that concludes our agenda here today. Is there any further discussion on anything? Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, April 8th. Please be watching your emails for any further updates. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.